You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The grid is not only something we can't get out of, it runs right through us. It dominates the way we look at the world around us.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, we ask, what would art do without right angles?
Nobody invented the grid. It's graph paper. There are grids in cave painting.
An urban planner explains why bunches of small rectangular blocks are good for democracy.
In New York, everybody gets to walk along or ride along the street. Doesn't matter if you're homeless, doesn't matter if you're the chairman of the corporation. You have to meet along the streets of the grid.
And we hear why one famous 20th century composer made up his own musical notation on graph paper.
Feldman's objective in using indeterminacy was not to give more freedom to the performer. Feldman wanted to free the sounds.
My guest is the painter Chuck Close.
Working within the incremental grid, it's not like a cage. I don't feel fenced in by it. I feel liberated by knowing I can find where I'm going.
That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. For 20 years, I wrote mainly nonfiction. And while I expressed lots of personal opinions over the years, the nonfiction I wrote was, as a matter of my choice, never very self-revelatory. A magazine article I wrote 20 years ago, musing on why I decided to marry my wife, was as close as I ever got to confessional writing, to going public with my personal life. Then, about 7 years ago, I started writing mostly fiction, novels, and some screenplays. And the kind of fiction I'm interested in writing is inherently self-revelatory. No one fictional character of mine is me, but most of them do carry bits and pieces of me. Thoughts I've had, emotions I've experienced, fantasies I've entertained. In fact, I think when you read almost any fiction writer's work, you get as clear and deep a glimpse into a stranger's mind, refracted, transmuted, deconstructed, sometimes only unwittingly revealed, as it's possible to get. One of the main characters in my first novel is missing a hand. His one-handedness doesn't define him. He doesn't whine or seek sympathy for it. It doesn't figure importantly in the story. It's just part of him, one of the things that make him who he is. People who read the book sometimes ask why I made that choice. And usually I shrug, which is a somewhat honest answer, since at the time I was writing, the choice was sudden and spontaneous. Why? I don't know. It just felt right. But in fact, after I finished the novel, I realized I sort of know why my make-believe character is slightly but unmistakably damaged, because it made him seem more human. Human in the sense that lots of us, no, make that all of us, live with some kind of irremediable flaw or wound or glitch, and simply live with it, usually privately. Our first story this week is about a fiction writer named Timothy Westmoreland. His glitch is type 1 diabetes, a chronic illness that need not be, for most people today, catastrophic. But for Westmoreland, the illness has been about as bad as can be, and it seems to shape all his fiction. Jerome Weeks talked with Timothy Westmoreland.
The disease that may eventually kill Timothy Westmoreland is the disease that got him into writing. Westmoreland wanted to be an astronomer. When he was a freshman at the University of Texas at Arlington, outside of Dallas, he was already so good at it, he was running the astronomy lab. But that's when Westmoreland learned that his life wasn't going to be what he dreamed. Since he was 7, he'd known that he had diabetes. But when he started having troubles with his sight in college, his optometrist referred him to another eye doctor.
And he told me, unless you can do the math in your head, the math that you're going to be required to do, you need to probably consider another career. Because I was beginning to show the initial signs of diabetic retinopathy. And so this was really a very devastating period of my life. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had planned my entire life.
Diabetes attacks the microvascular systems, the body's tiny blood vessels. Westmoreland has only 30% of his kidney function. He has had more than 20 operations on his eyes alone, and he still may go blind of his retina's hemorrhage. Westmoreland sank into a 2-year depression, but then he started reading the fiction of John Updike and took creative writing courses. This, he thought, was something he could do, something not that different from astronomy.
People don't think of astronomy or physics as a creative process, but it is. It's about recognizing patterns, recognizing order, and trying to explain those patterns. And I also found that writing fiction assuaged that depression and the feeling that I was somehow inept and decrepit at the same time. And I felt in some ways that being able to write defied those inevitabilities, the things that were going wrong with my body.
Westmoreland's stories, in good as any, have a haunting quality of unspoken things. They've been compared to Russell Banks and Raymond Carver's for their blue-collar bleakness, their deadpan humor, and their moments of unexpected beauty, as in this excerpt from the story Strong at the Broken Places. The narrator has watched his friend Murphy tear apart his kitchen in the middle of the winter and, oddly enough, build a planetarium in the remains. When he's through, Murphy, his estranged wife Kathy, and the narrator celebrate by drinking absinthe and setting a fire in a trash can, using it as a backyard grill.
As though a shotgun blast filled the space between us, I felt the concussion. The lid of the trash can rose in an instant, as high as the roof, flaming coals reaching even higher into the limbs of the chestnut. Shards of fire drifted in the air, high up above us, and met with the stars. I felt as though we were liquefying, emerging into the center of the universe. Fire burned in places at the tips of tree limbs. Coals came down on the cedar roof, burned a pale white. Others drifted down and lit the dry grass. All that had been raised, lifted on the hot air, seemed to take the longest time to settle. In the trees, in the grass, on the roof of the house, asterisks of fire flickered like stars. Murphy lumbered forward toward the house. Kathy and I could only watch, stunned under the air of the absinthe. Murphy moved slowly far out into the grass and into the darkness and the fire. It seemed as if he walked among the stars.
What prompts Murphy's bout of destruction and carpentry is the news from his doctors that he's dying. This is typical of Westmoreland's stories. His characters have cancer. They've been in car wrecks. They look at the able-bodied world from an outsider's angle. To be sure, there's a long history of illness and disability in literature, from poet John Milton's blindness, which figures in his drama, Samson Agonistes, Dostoevsky's epilepsy, which afflicts a character in The Brothers Karamazov. But in more recent years, fiction writers have tended to step aside into nonfiction to address their troubles directly in memoirs and essays, like Reynolds Price in his book A Whole New Life, which concerns his paraplegia. Westmoreland writes fiction that features disease and disability, but not as a heavy-handed social cause. It's just another wound in a wounded world. This approach didn't come naturally for him. It was only after both his mother and mother-in-law died of cancer that he began to explore human ailments as part of his fiction.
And there was a whole emotional world, a dimension that had not been known to me consciously. But what I began to explore there were the fears and the complications and the way that illness does, in the same way that, say, race or gender or ethnicity shapes your identity, illness does also.
One thing that a severe illness can change, Westmoreland knows, is time. It warps it. It speeds it up. It slows you down. Timothy Westmoreland is 36, but he has the body, he says, of a rapidly aging 65-year-old. For Studio 360, I'm Jerome Weeks.
Timothy Westmoreland's book of short stories is called Good as Any. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. If you've got a pencil and you're not driving a car, I want you to draw a tic-tac-toe board in front of you. Now look up, look around. Do you see that shape anywhere? That grid and its intersecting lines are probably in your window, maybe your ceiling, definitely on your calendar. You might even have a checked or plaid shirt on. Now think about the grids you can't see, the steel beams holding up the building you're in, or the electric wires and cables to your home and all the homes around you, or the lines of latitude and longitude that encircle the Earth. The grid is everywhere. Today, we're looking at how right angles and intersections can give us structure, limits, and creative freedom in art and design and daily life. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. Chuck Close led a kind of renaissance of portraiture in the 1970s with his somewhat photorealistic paintings of faces. His canvases were and are gigantic 9-foot-tall heads of family and friends, most famously like the composer Philip Glass. The black and white pictures were meticulous and cool, and they earned Close worldwide fame. And then he changed his style. His paintings of the last decade or so explode with pixelated blobs of color. The faces all emerge out of little squares of purple and orange and red and green, mammoth grids of beautiful color. Chuck Close, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
And I want to tell our listeners, since they'll hear the sort of portentous echo of your voice, that we are speaking to you from your studio Long Island. And you're surrounded by your work, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you start painting?
I think I knew from a very early age, probably 5, because I asked my father to make an easel for me for Christmas when I was 5 years old. And shortly thereafter, I nudged them to get a box of genuine artist oil paints from the Sears Roebuck catalog. So I think I was off and running at a relatively early age. And I was studying privately with a woman at the age of 8. And I was actually drawing and painting for the nude model at age 8, which made me the envy of everyone in my neighborhood.
I'll bet. So you were sort of an art prodigy.
Yeah, I had all my eggs in that basket. I was learning disabled, although in the 40s and 50s, nobody knew from learning disabilities. I was just dumb.
But how did your learning disability manifest itself?
Oh, I couldn't memorize any. I still don't know the multiplication tables. And it's sort of ironic that I use the grid and things that seem mathematic. I don't do any measurements with a ruler. I work it all out without the use of a calculator or anything. Also, part of my learning disability was being overwhelmed by the whole, and I found it to be particularly helpful to use a grid to isolate one small piece that I could work on and forget about the rest of the picture. But at a certain point in my work, I began to let the grid show and to leave it as part of the picture.
Well, and for the last dozen years, that your grid has sort of come into the foreground and, to my eye, has made your work just come alive with that tension between the grid, the image that is being depicted, the paint.
It's a tension between the flat grid and then the image it warps into. It is the artificiality. A painting is a very artificial thing anyhow. It's colored dirt on a flat surface. But the grid calls attention to the fact that it's a flat surface.
Well, and what's interesting is, so you're now calling more attention to that you are an artist, that this is art, this is not some simulation of reality. Yet people also, critics seem to find your work of the last decade or so warmer, friendlier, which seems counterintuitive. Those two things don't seem to go together usually.
Well, you know, often with limitations, they seem one would think that they would be, that they would narrow things down, it would restrict you, it would be this rigorous self-imposed system that would limit you. In fact, often the opposite is true. It tends to kick open doors and make for I've functioned in a far more intuitive way than I did when I could do whatever I wanted at any place on the canvas.
Which I think goes to the heart of the sort of the source of the power of something like the grid. Exactly those kinds of – out of those constraints come a sort of ability to do your work within those confines.
It's also a way to – it's also a record of the process. It's a record of the thought process that the viewer can get in sync with. I was recently living in Rome, and I was looking at the humble Roman floor mosaics, and there the viewing distance is the height of the viewer. You look down at the floor, and there is a floor made up of chunks of stone. And just when you get used to looking at the chunks of stone on that flat surface, it warps into an animal or a head or whatever. And just when you're comfortable looking at the animal or head, it flattens back out and insists on being seen as a flat floor made up chunks of stone. And the wonderful thing is that across the centuries, it's as if I'm looking over the shoulder of the artisan who made that floor, and I can see the record of the thought process that he used, where he chipped a little corner off the stone and nudged it in, and three or four or five or six of those stones become a piece of a face or an eyeball or something. It's something that you instantly, the viewer can instantly understand as a process.
One of your processes that we see very clearly now in these paintings is that you don't just put up this rectangular canvas and do it, mark it out like a tic-tac-toe board. Everything, your canvases as you make them are tilted at a 45-degree diagonal. Why do you do that?
Often I do that because the insistent beat of the grid when it's horizontal and vertical, something about the way our brain functions sees that grid in a more insistent way. You can never quite get away from the grid. But by tilting it at an angle, our brain doesn't process it in quite the same way. So the grid loses some of its insistent rhythmic beat. And I found that it also does some interesting things formally. It gives a kind of pinking shears edge to the outside of form as it zigzags down down the canvas.
Oh, that's interesting because essentially your pictures are made up of diamonds. Then at the edge, they're right. Half diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Chuck Close is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. And in a minute, we'll look at how other visual artists explore the grid. So stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is supported in part by Nonesuch Records, featuring Reveries, the new album by Italian songwriter Paolo Conte, whose observations of the human condition are set to the sounds of swing, tango, and cabaret. Available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we are talking about the grid. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. We asked a producer, Simon Rettner, to find out how the grid has served artists throughout history.
Grids go back as far as we know there is any kind of expressive impulse in human beings.
Professor Rosalind Krauss wrote back in 1978 that the grid is almost mystical.
I mean, nobody invented the grid. It's graph paper. There are grids in cave painting. It's simply a way of rationalizing the deployment of images on a plane surface.
During the early Renaissance, Florentine architect Filippo Brunelleschi discovered a way to use a grid that would permanently change Western art. Brunelleschi drew a system of converging lines to one particular point on a canvas. And for the first time, he could accurately depict the Piazza della Signoria in three dimensions. Here is art critic Dan Cameron.
He suddenly had this idea of rendering things in perspective as a tool, as something that didn't have any necessary meaning of its own. And with time, that tool then became the springboard for other innovations and other developments in architecture. For example, the idea of the assembly line would never have been possible without the idea of rendering this idea of an orderly process in space.
During the 20th century, at the height of modernism, the grid pushed its way to the foreground. Abstract painters like Piet Mondrian and Agnes Martin employed the grid for their entire careers as the primary pictorial image in their artwork. They believed their paintings were a gateway towards transcendence and absolute harmony.
Well, the way Agnes Martin uses grids is to, well, she draws the grid, the lines of the grids in graphite pencil on canvases that have been stained a very pale color. The grid breaks up that plain surface, the sort of physical fact of a monochrome canvas, and causes it to shimmer in the way that, say, impressionist brushstrokes cause an atmospheric shimmer on the surface of the canvas. And this gives the quality of cloudiness to Martin's paintings.
I don't think that this kind of abstraction makes sense anymore in our age. I think it did at a time when we were still very much in the thrall of modernism and the possibility of an optimistic future through modern thought and modern expression. I think it was very much a part of the culture that we lived in and the air that we breathed. To some degree, Agnes Martin's work or Mondrian's work is an expression of this idea of the pure grid seen in and of itself, unadorned, unframed, unmarked, unblemished. And now the grid is I mean, it's corrupted. It's teeming and overflowing with life. The grid is inhabited. It's a real concrete place. We're in the middle of it.
Cameron has gathered the work of 24 artists from all over the world in a show he called Living Inside the Grid. Jennifer Blandy builds models of buildings using contact sheets of photography, lighting them from within like light boxes. Her latest is an 8-foot model of the Lever House, a landmark skyscraper conceived by Gordon Bunshaft in 1957. The way Blandy put it together, each brightly lit office window is a different frame of photography. But as you gaze voyeuristically into the windows, you notice that some of them contain glowing cubes of washing machines and dryers.
I was photographing these various store windows downtown, and there was an appliance store that they hadn't changed their window display since around 1957. And it was illuminated at night, and it was just a really beautiful, almost ethereal vision. And I took a lot of photographs of that window, which is broken up into these little modular units of washing machines and refrigerators and dryers, the kind of things that are supposed to make life easier.
Blandy's building radiates with the same aquamarine luminescence of the real Lever House in Midtown Manhattan, only she calls it Appliance House.
It's kind of like the fading glow of yesterday's promise or something, I think. Of course, I had to project myself into one of the office spaces in the Lever House to sort of insert the one human presence into this structure that's otherwise just populated by appliances.
Frames within frames within frames, the grid not only proliferates as an essential tool for organizing space and ideas, but it provides us with a greater metaphor for understanding contemporary life.
The grid is not only something we can't get out of. It runs right through us. It dominates the way we look at the world around us. It is sort of the irreducible sign, if you want, of the world that we live in today.
I think of artists as kind of recognizers of patterns. And, you know, yes, the grid is a prevalent structure, but I think that there are other structures around which our imaginations or our lives can circle. I have to believe that.
For Studio 360, I'm Simon Rentner.
You can see images of Jennifer Bolandi's and Agnes Martin's work and of the show Living Inside the Grid at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with Chuck Close. Chuck, do you buy that idea that nobody invented the grid, that it's somehow primal and has some mystical, essential meaning or power or existential truth?
You know, everything from fabric, everything else that's woven, the grid has been part of how things have been constructed. Thatching and woven structures. I think it grew out of necessity and practicality, and it would have been there no matter what.
I guess in a certain sense, the grid is the ultimate obvious convenience to sewing things together, building inhabitable structures, all of it. And that's where it comes from.
I know that one of the really important primal experiences for me as a child was watching my grandmother knit and crochet and build, make quilts and afghans and things like that, a lot of which look a lot like my work today. She also made, she would crochet small pieces and then put them together to make even bigger pieces. I think there's a lot of what I do that has a lot to do with what was traditionally called women's work. So I think it has a lot to do with construction. And I try to build a painting rather than paint it.
That's interesting. It's like there's an almost primal quality to grids, and we as humans know they're there even if we aren't entirely conscious of knowing they're there.
I think it goes back to something that I think we feel within our body, the rhythmic beat of the grid. Music, tapping your foot to the beat of music and feeling when music changes from one kind of time to another. Those are things that you feel with your body, and I think through your eyes you feel incremental spaces as well. You're driving down the road and the rhythm of the telephone poles or the fence posts, you begin to feel it rather than think it. And so I think that's why everyone feels they have such a personal investment in or take on things that are made that way. They understand it. I think as an artist, I drop crumbs on the trail, Hansel and Gretel style, you know, for people to pick up, and they can understand how things happen, how things get built, demystify the process. But we all sense it. We all feel it, whether we intellectualize it or not.
Chuck Close is my guest. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about the grid. And our next story is about a composer who decided that graph paper could help set his music free. Chuck, you knew Morton Feldman, right?
Yes, I did. He was a wonderful guy and a great friend of visual artists. He was Philip Guston's really good friend, and Philip was teaching at Yale when I was there, and he brought Morty up a bunch of times. And he was a terrific composer and a really interesting guy, and his approach was decidedly visual.
Well, and as you know, Feldman created a whole new way of notating music in the 1960s. It included a lot of scribbled marks in rows of little boxes, his own quirky grid. The music was more beautiful than that presentation suggests, and it had lyrical titles like The King of Denmark. The percussionist Jan Williams knew Feldman quite well. They taught college together in Buffalo until Feldman's death 16 years ago. In the story we're about to play, you'll hear parts of an interview Williams did with Feldman about the King of Denmark and the music scholar David Bernstein describing how Feldman's grid worked. The first voice is Jan Williams.
You have to realize that we talked all the time. I mean, we lived close to each other in downtown Buffalo. He didn't drive, and I, you know, drove him to school all the time. I mean, we were together all the time working on projects, or just simply together talking.
The grid, Marty, you'd been working with one of the first, actually, to work with a particular type of notation.
So, when we did this interview, it wasn't that odd for me to sit down and talk to Morton. The only thing about the interview was I was sort of asking the questions instead of him directing where things were going to go, you know.
Would you care to talk a little bit about how that evolved? And you're very important in terms of that.
Oh, it's like one of those things that you don't know is going to have, you know, significance afterwards.
Feldman's objective in using indeterminacy was not to give more freedom to the performer. Feldman wanted to free the sounds. He saw traditional notation as being somewhat analogous to pictures, frozen pictures, and the new notation as being more plastic and more morphological.
There was something about the wistfulness of things not lasting, of impermanence.
I think probably one of the first pieces I heard of his was The King of Denmark. Yeah, Town Hall, performance at Town Hall in the early, well, he wrote it in 64, so it must have been shortly after that.
I actually remember writing The King. It was, I was on the beach in the south shore of Long Island, and I wrote it in a few hours, just sitting comfortably on the beach. I wrote the whole piece on the beach. And I actually can conjure up the memory of doing it, that kind of muffled sound of kids in the distance, you know, and transistor radios and drips of conversation from other pockets of inhabitants on blankets. And I remember that it did come into the piece. By that I mean these kind of wisps.
I did immediately got a hold of a copy of it. It was published by Peters, C.F. Peters. It was one of the few pieces at the time that I encountered that was not in traditional notation. That was to say, it was a grid, free hand, kind of drawn grid.
Graphic, like on graph paper.
If you could imagine three rows of boxes, one on top of the other.
What emerged was the high, middle, and low categories.
The registers are laid out with the graph. Each box stands for a pulse or a beat, which could be between the metronomic marking of 66, as slow as 66 and as fast as 92.
And then within those, he had various types of graphics, mostly dots or numbers or whatever, which represented certain things to the player.
There are symbols for simultaneities. There are symbols for rolls. An R in a box stands for a roll.
The performer has a certain degree of flexibility in terms of rhythms and gesture. No two performances are ever going to sound the same.
Feldman says that all instruments to be played without sticks or mallets, the performer may use fingers, hand, or any part of his arm.
This input that you had meant that you had a different kind of contact with the music than if you were playing a Beethoven sonata, for example. And realizing at the time that the decisions you were making were unique, as the decisions the composer made were unique. So it's, you know, you felt you had a really close, I felt anyway, that I had a really closer, more intimate connection with the piece.
Everybody always asks me about the title, The King of Denmark. The King of Denmark, if one will remember, went out into a Copenhagen square with the star of, of Israel, around, you know, that the Jews had to wear around.
Right.
Oh, man. and it was like a silent protest. And he just walked around, didn't say anything.
Right.
How I made the leap from the beach to this other thing, I don't know. But there was a very strong connection there.
The composer Morten Feldman. He was speaking in 1983 about his composition, The King of Denmark, which you heard. You also heard the percussionist Jan Williams and David Bernstein, who's a professor at Mills College in California. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the painter Chuck Close, who is talking to me, I think, probably not far from the beach on which Morten Feldman composed the music we just heard.
I think that's true.
It's interesting. I was as Jan Williams was talking about this intimate experience he felt as a player of that music because of this unusual notation. It reminded me of what you said earlier about your sense of leaving as an artist, leaving breadcrumbs, a trail of breadcrumbs for people to follow. It sounds like something similar was going on between Feldman and his players there.
Yes, and what I was saying earlier about restrictions. Limitations opening things up and allowing you to behave more intuitively. He built elbow room for his musicians to interpret the music, and that flexibility became a great deal of what the experience of the piece was ultimately about.
Do you feel as though, I mean, we think of a grid as being almost a symbol of, you know, impersonality and mechanistic imposition. Can a grid be the basis for soulfulness?
Yeah, I've accepted other things rather than a complete grid or a strict left to right, top to bottom grid. I did works with my fingerprints and pieces of pulp paper, little discs that are wafer-like. And those are still incremental, but they don't follow a strict left to right, top to bottom grid. And many people seem to find those works to be particularly emotionally laden. Robert Storr, who was the curator of my retrospective at the Modern, talked about my fingerprint paintings as being almost like caressing the face of the person that I'm painting, and the idea that skin makes skin. Which I thought was a kind of nice idea, and also it makes art that can't be forged.
And when you did return, and the colors and the forms that you make in each of your squares now seem more biomorphic or organic than they were. Did you get there, do you think, by, you know, is it a dialectic process from your early work to the fingerprints to what you're doing now?
Well, it's found and felt. You find it while you're kind of moving through the landscape. In a sense, there's a kind of Brobdingnagian world when you make an image this big. It's like Gulliver's Lilliputians crawling over the face of the giant, not even knowing what they're on, just tripping over a beard hair and falling into a nostril. So I just sort of found them in the act of painting. I always thought that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. I know that my paintings are going to look a lot like the photograph that I work from. Iconographically, it will be ahead. I know where I'm going to end up, but I don't know the route that I'm going to take. And so much is embedded in the process of following that path wherever it leads, and the things you bump into, the ideas that occur to you through the act of painting, through the process of building a painting, are so different from the ones that you sit around and dream up. If you wait for the clouds to part and for you to be struck in the head with a bolt of lightning, you're liable to wait for the rest of your life. But if you simply get going, something will occur to you.
The painter Chuck Close is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. And coming up, we'll hear how the grid shapes your own life. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the painter Chuck Close, and we're talking about grids. Practically every piece of this country is built on a grid, whether it's the checkerboard pattern of farmland or towns and cities' systems of streets. Our next story takes us out to the streets of Lower Manhattan, where I took a walk with Marilyn Taylor. Marilyn Taylor is the chairman of the architecture firm of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and heads its urban design and planning practice. Her firm, among other things, is rebuilding Seven World Trade, one of the buildings destroyed alongside the Twin Towers. And so, on a late spring afternoon, we walked around those blocks toward the empty World Trade Center site. And I asked her why the grid is so central to the process of making cities.
I actually think of the grid as starting from the idea of parceling a city up into pieces small enough to build at a time. When the Romans laid out the grids, when Savannah, Georgia laid out its grids, when New York City laid out its grids in 1811, the idea was really to create a uniform set of parcels that would then fairly support relatively equal development as you move through the city. And in the case of New York, as the city moved north from City Hall all the way up through Midtown and eventually all the way up to Morningside Heights and beyond.
Are there places, I mean, here we are in New York, where, you know, a certain kind of urban grid was invented and perfected, and America is a place that was just laid out from sea to sea as a series of grids. Are there other countries where this isn't the way to think about how to organize cities and spaces and countries?
If we look at what various cultures wanted to create, they had different ideas. The Chinese laid out cities almost the way the Romans did, with a major east-west axis and a major north-south axis, and then not a uniform grid, but a grid which kept changing and altering the size of the streets. And that led to a place like Tokyo, where you have certain big boulevards, and then you have slightly smaller streets, and then you have wonderful alley backways. They run in a grid, but each of the streets has a very different character for its size and scale. New York's grid is a special grid. You know, the fact that one side is short and one side is long, it helps give you orientation, it emphasizes that river-to-river connection. I think it's far more interesting than a city like Houston, where the grids are squares, and where they tend to take on just one building to fill it out. One of the brilliance of the New York grids is that very few buildings are large enough to consume it all. And even those that do tend to be made of multiple parts, tall elements that anchor the avenues and lower mid-blocks in between.
So you have this big grid, but within it there's all kinds of small grain texture.
One of the things about New York City is that the grid has saved it from having so many of the huge super blocks that were created in other cities in the 1960s and 1970s in the name of urban redevelopment. And what tended to happen in those large super blocks was something that felt really walled off. In New York, every 200 feet, everybody gets to walk along or ride along the street. Doesn't matter if you're homeless, doesn't matter if you're the chairman of the corporation, you have to meet along the streets of the grid. So it's a very democratic, a very democratizing influence on the city.
Well, and isn't that very issue of the super block, and New York's great example of the super block that kind of ignored the old grid, is where we're approaching right here, where the World Trade Center stood until 2 years ago.
Well, and here we walk on a street that assumes the pattern of the grid, Vesey Street, looking down to the river, looking not quite back to the East River on the other side, and we are about to come to the super block that was the World Trade Center. The site for the World Trade Center consisted of 12 different blocks. There were three intermediate east-west streets and two intermediate north-south streets, 12 blocks that were compressed into the one super block that became the World Trade Center. And for whatever love, affection, interest we had in the symbolism of the Twin Towers, the way the base met the city was really anti-urban, very difficult, uninviting, and out of the sadness, at least there's a chance to fix that now. One of the ways we fix it, putting some streets back in.
Some of these and several streets form dead ends against this construction wall. Will some of these streets run through?
Well, we We walk down Vesey Street, which is the site on the north of the World Trade Center site. The next one here on the other side of St. Paul's Church is Fulton Street, and this is the street that will come straight through the site, a regular public street, a democratizing influence on the World Trade Center site. The other two streets are Day and Cortland, and they can come through either as pedestrian passages and or pedestrian areas free and open to the sky. Maybe they'll twist a little bit. But again, it's that sense of the public penetrating into and through and clear to the other side that I think will be the wonderful new characteristic of the World Trade Center site. Everyone can get to the memorial, everyone can get to the cultural facilities, everyone can feel like it's a piece of the land that they are visiting.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it? Every quarter hour.
You mentioned that Houston, for instance, which has these perfectly square blocks as the components of its grid, can be boring as a city as a result. We talked about how the super blocks gave us a piece of city that wasn't beautiful or humane. Are there other ways in which this idea of the grid, this kind of to which we always return, or to which you urban planners always return, can go wrong?
Well, I think there are two big dangers with the grid. The first is the implication that everything is the same, block after block after block, that it's not just a footprint, but it's a form. Imagine if all the hundreds of grid blocks in New York City were built exactly the same. We wouldn't know where we are any more than we do in those deadening suburbs. But there's another danger of the grid, and one that's very important to think about, and I think that it's one that pertains as you go further and further west in the United States, which is that there's a careful balance between how much is land and how much is street. And the more the streets become wider, the more they become larger in proportion to the blocks around them, then the less able we are to use the buildings and the human activities to define the nature of the streets. So for me, that's the biggest risk. And that's why we as planners and architects have to continue to think about ways that enliven the grid as a place for people, not just as a place for taxis, cars, trucks.
So not let the grid control us, but keep it in hand as a patterning device, but not become the kind of totalitarian ruler of our lives.
Exactly.
The urban planner Marilyn Taylor walking with me around the neighborhoods surrounding the World Trade Center site. That piece was produced by Studio 360's Lita Molad. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we are talking about the grid. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. It's interesting to me, Chuck, listening to her talk about that balancing act that cities and urban planners have to do between not letting the grid become too prominent but using it. In its formal qualities, it sounds not so different from what you talk about in how you use it and not let it overwhelm and keep, you know, none of your 100,000 squares or whatever are the same. They're all different.
Yeah, and I think, using the grid, a painter is a kind of orchestrator of experience, and cities are experiences laid out for us. And I thought the comment that everyone meets on the street and has to rub elbows, people of the highest social order and the homeless share that same boulevard. I think that's a noble aspiration and was actually part of the planning, say, of Central Park. Central Park was a social experiment. It was designed to entice people of all classes into an area where they would have to confront each other and have to share space. There's something extremely noble about that as an idea, and maybe idealistic in that. But it works. It works to this day. You see the wealthiest people, walk by, homeless person sitting on a bench.
You're making daguerreotypes now, a form of proto-photography with which I'm very fascinated. What was the attraction for you to daguerreotypes?
Well, the interesting thing about a daguerreotype is that it's it was the first form of capturing an image. There were camera obscura images, which as soon as there were lenses, people found a way, and even with a pinhole, even without a lens, found a way to get a projected image. But it was elusive. It disappeared. And there was a way, everyone wanted to find a way to fix that image. And the first form of fixing that image was in the 1840s by Daguerre. And he found that he could get a polished sheet of pure silver to, in essence, either absorb light or reflect light. So the interesting thing about them is the object status. For me, there are very elusive images. Only one person at a time can look at it. It's not like 10 people can stand in front of a big photograph and all look at it as if it were a big painting.
Because you need to look at it from just the right angle.
Just the right angle. It's very and it's usually tilted, and it's very much like holding a book or something in your hand. It's very intimate, and it requires the active participation of the viewer to get just the right vantage point to see it. And you also can see your own image reflected in it, which is telling you, I am looking at a flat surface, a mirror-like flat surface.
Chuck Close, thanks for joining me today in Studio 360.
My pleasure.
Chuck Close's next book comes out this fall from Princeton University Press. It's called Chuck Close Prints, Process and Collaboration. His most recent self-portrait will be on view at the 50th Biennale in Venice from June 15th until November 2nd. And you can find out more about him at studio360.org. When you go to studio360.org, you can also listen to archived editions of everything we've done in Studio 360 over the past 2 years. To close the show today, we introduce you to a musician named Ken Butler. We tell you what instruments he plays, except you've never heard of them, because Ken Butler invents and builds everything he plays. Okay.
Body of the shovel, the blade of the shovel, and it has a one contact microphone and three strings tuned to DAD. Here's how the strings sound. And the blade of the shovel functions as a percussion device, so you can get a lot of good, rich sounds out of banging on the blade of the shovel. I would use those together by looping that and playing over it at something like this. The very first instrument actually was made when I saw an axe in the basement. I had been thinking a little bit about the iconography of an instrument, head, neck, body, how instruments were perhaps related to the human body. Well, I suppose I could try to play it. So I just continued to pursue that idea. And, you know, then I ended up now, I've made 400 musical instruments. Well, this is called a hockey racket. The blade of the hockey stick goes into my pocket, which is how it holds itself up. Then, in the body of the tennis racket, there are all these imbira-like or thumb piano-like objects. So all these things can be tweaked with a guitar pick or your finger. These are little bits of the inside of a sewing machine, a bolt that I'll scrape along, and then my right hand I will be plucking on part of a metal guitar pick, some bobby pins, a little bit of a ruler, part of a vegetable slicer, and a drink stirrer. I really love aspects of very primitive things. And that the idea of the real initial invention, the very first musical instruments were rocks and bones and sticks. And then the most current contemporary musical instruments are computers. And so somewhere a way to bridge those things is of interest to me, but in a sculptural way too. In other words, for me, my favorite computer music would be to take the actual power book, and put a neck and strings on the computer itself and use the actual shell of the computer as a sound object by putting a microphone on it. That's the way I would think.
You can see some of Ken Butler's homemade instruments at studio360.org. Mallory Kasdan produced that story. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly, Matthew
Sherman, Jessica Wettstein,
Megan Metcalf,
Andy Lancet.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tiegel. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan. Additional support is provided by Nonesuch Records, featuring Reveries, the new album by Italian songwriter Paolo Conte, whose observations of the human condition are set to the sounds of swing, tango, and cabaret. Available at tower.com/nonesuch.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
Tell us about your quarrel with Joe Bradford over the defendant. Go on, Mr. Sands, tell us.
The legal system as pop culture.
Everybody seems to be interested in the question of how evil happens. It's why we watch TV dramas about criminals.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me and the writer Scott Turow next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.